Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon, and once again, we continue to flip through the pages of the big old binder, and we're almost done taking a look at 1979 Tops this week, and our random poll card number 360, the man who could do everything, 360 degrees of baseball, Amos Otis, or AO, as the Royals fans would call him for many, many years. And, of course, you've got legendary Royals players like George Brett. You would have Brett Saberhagen in the 80s. You would have several standout players, Frank White, Willie Wilson, just to name a few. But Amos Otis was one of the first stars. I won't call him the first star because Lou Piniella in 1969 was pretty much the first star for the Royals. He was the American League Rookie of the Year that year. But Amos Otis would go on to be a mainstay in Kansas City throughout the 1970s and into the early 1980s. Doesn't quite get the credit that he's due because he had a pretty solid career. Pretty good dude. Interesting path to Kansas City, which we will get to in just a few minutes. Also, we've changed things up just a little bit. If you haven't listened to our latest podcast, the Bubblegum Bonus Podcast that we posted this past Friday, it featured the survey responses to our most recent listener survey. It was our second survey in the past 6 months, determining the direction of the show. So first of all, the overall direction, in case you haven't been able to listen to that show, and you can listen to it in the archive section on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or TuneIn. But if you weren't able to listen to it, I'll give you a brief overview. Basically, after we get through the big old binder, which is the next show, 1980 Tops, we will be doing the just random pulls from the whole collection. We're not going to go in any kind of chronological order. There's not going to be a whole lot of rhyme or reason to it. Basically, every week, I'll just pull a card from either the big old binder or the big old monster box. We'll talk a little bit about that player and the card set. And also, we had some great suggestions about some special shows. I'm really thinking about doing the baseball memorabilia one. I don't have a ton of memorabilia, but I do have pennants. And also, wax wrapper art. We could talk a little bit about some of the designs on the wax wrappers, especially in the 1960s and 70s. Tops in particular got away from it in the 1980s, as did Fleer and Donruss. You know, they kind of had a little bit of artwork in the 1981 set, but they got away from that as the companies were more interested in just simply branding their product throughout the competitive 1980s in the hobby, as opposed to, you know, putting up some works of art. Although you did have some along the way, but not quite like you did in the 60s and 70s. So we may do some special shows like that, looking to get a couple of guests on from around the history of the hobby. We'll eventually get around to that again after the 1980 top set. So a lot of exciting stuff coming up here with Wax Ecstatic. Again, the randomness of pulling different cards and different players. We'll have the occasional guest. We'll go off on a tangent a little bit, maybe on memorabilia or rapper art or any other topic. So again, thanks to everybody who tuned in and chimed in with the listener survey. And again, if you couldn't catch all of the responses on what we're doing with the show, give a listen to the Bubblegum Bonus episode again on the archives of Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And one of the suggestions was to shorten the show just a tiny bit, so we're going to make the show a little more punchier. But also, people want to talk about the cards and the players right off the bat, so we're going to move our listener mailbag, if you will, to the end of the show. So we'll check out our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, at the end of the program. And without further ado, let's dive into 1979 Tops, a set that is definitely one of those you either love it or you don't. I don't think it's a bad set. I mean, I look at it and there's a lot of things to like about 79 Tops, but when you look back at 78 Tops, and then certainly the more creative efforts before then, 77, 76, 75, somebody went crazy with the paint set, but 74, 73, you know, there was something that was kind of authentic about it. You know, there was just this, you know, this original feel to the designs and the whole layout. A lot of things in 79 Topps feel forced. And there's a good reason for it, and that's because Topps was starting to feel the heat of a very lengthy lawsuit that was brought on to them by the folks at Fleer. And it's a lawsuit that goes back to 1975. Now, I will get into the details of the lawsuit in next week's episode, because 1980 was the last year that Topps completely cornered the market. But there were hints then that they knew that the time was up. They were going to have to relinquish this 25-year-old monopoly and actually have to face legitimate Major League Baseball and Major League Baseball Players Association-backed competition. First in Fleer, and then Donruss came along in 1981 as well. But just know that in 1979, Topps was clearly feeling that the end game was coming soon, and it was not going to be in their favor. So they started prepping themselves for some competition by making the most memorable mark on 79 Topps baseball cards. And all you have to do is just take a look at the front of this Amos Otis card. And yeah, you see the picture of Amos. It's pretty easy to see. You see the team name, you see his name, but in a baseball, it's not a team logo, or it's not a position, or, you know, the abbreviation for the position of the player. It's the Topps logo. This was the first time in Topps history. So we're going back to, you know, really the late 1940s, but in the realm of modern baseball cards, you're going to 1951. This was the first time in almost 30 years of Topps history that they had to emblazon their logo on the front of the card. And the logo, while it's branding, okay, we get it, this is a Topps baseball card, it was a little unnecessary because in the form of a true baseball card, the 2.5-inch by 3.5-inch piece of cardboard, with a photo of a player on the front and detailed career information on the back, Topps was still the only game in town. Now, Fleer had some products out at the time, like the logo stickers and cloth stickers and stuff like that. But the true, honest-to-goodness baseball card, Fleer was still not quite in the market yet. But Topps felt like it had to mark the territory by doing the tramp stamp of baseball cards, if you will, with this ginormous baseball and logo in the lower left-hand corner of every card. Now, this is a 726-card set, so the Topps brand was featured everywhere on the front of these cards. You couldn't get away from it. And that is something that collectors still to this day don't like. It's just very annoying to give up so much space to really an unnecessary, in the mind of many collectors, an unnecessary feature to this card here. Now, while the logo is forced on there, the other parts also seem to be forced on there. There was a simplicity to 78 Topps. There was a simplicity to 77 and 76 in particular. But the design of 79 Topps feels a little bit, I hate to say this, corporate. It really does. It just seems like you had somebody, you know, it's kid tested, mother approved. It just seemed to go through 5, 6, 7 levels of clearance before it was produced, where a 78 Topps, I mean, granted, it went through the certain levels of clearance before production, but there was a more authentic feel to 78 Topps. And for many of the cards in the 1970s, in 79, it doesn't feel that way. And let's take a look at the Amos Otis card here, as we've got roughly 80 to 85% of the front of the card is devoted to the picture of Amos striking his batting pose at the Oakland Alameda Coliseum. As I mentioned in a previous podcast, you would see a lot of cards featuring guys either in Oakland or in San Francisco, as Topps would have a photographer in both the West Coast and East Coast, one in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Area, another in New York City. So the Royals were clearly in Oakland at some point in time, probably in 1978, although this picture might be from 1977, batting practice time, and they grab a picture of Otis in those beautiful powder blue Royals unis. And that's one of the classic road uniforms from the 1970s. And I've always liked the 1970s Royals road jerseys, the blue ones, as opposed to the 1980s, just by a hair. The Royals started wearing this particular road jersey in 1972. They would change it in, I believe it was 1983, but the first blue road uniform for the Royals not only had the powder blue and the Royal emblem on the left shoulder, but you also had Kansas City spelled out in these arc block letters. And I've always liked that over the simple Royal script that the Royals would use in the mid to late 80s. And they unfortunately dumped the blue jersey in, when was it, 1989, I believe, was the last year that they had the blue jersey. Or maybe it was 1990. And they bring it back every now and then. But this is one of my absolute favorites in Royals history. By the way, Royals, the whole gold trim after you won the World Series, that was good. But you not only haven't won a World Series in 2 years, but you're falling very fast. Stop wearing the gold trim. Just get back to basics, okay? Stop wearing the gold trim. That's like the University of Miami, you know, walking around with championship t-shirts. It's been a while, boys. Come on. All right, let's. What have you done for me lately? That's what we're talking about here. All right, so Amos Otis, roughly 85% of the front of the card devoted to this picture. And Topps did have some pretty good photographs in the 1979 set, not just for vivid color, as you can see in this particular picture. You've got, you know, the Royals blue, you've got the green field and the green and some brown seats in the Oakland Coliseum. But you do have some pretty good action shots in this set as well. So that's one of the good things about 79 Topps. Now, you have this, you know, decent design, but again, it just feels a little too rigid. Right beneath the picture of Otis, you have the aforementioned ball with the Topps logo. You've got Amos's name, the abbreviation for his position. And then in this, it's not really a pennant, is it? It's more like a scarf at the very bottom here. You've got the team name here, and that was pretty much it. So is it simple in design for the most part, other than the giant Topps logo, but it just feels a little forced. It feels a little cut. It feels, again, like, you know, Topps is starting to feel the pressure of the Fleer lawsuit, and they just suddenly went, okay, we need to get nice and clean and straightened up here, and we've got to have this really pristine product that's put out there. And that kind of takes the fun away from it. So while there was a fun feel to, again, I point out 76, 77, 78 Topps, and 79, not really. Again, it's not a bad design. It's not one of those designs like, you know, 82 Topps I've never really cared for. And then you can bring up some of the worst designs in baseball card history. 82 Fleer, 90 Donruss. You can bring up, 88 Topps I'm not a big fan of. You know, there are some that are truly boring, blah, who cares. That is not 79 Topps. But what 79 Topps design is, and especially the front of the cards, it is the beginning of the slippery slope. I've mentioned in our podcast on 77 and 78 Topps, some collectors feel like that was the beginning of the dry period for Topps in creativity. So you can debate, all right, 77 wasn't as good as some of the earlier 70s cards. All right, 78's kind of plain. It's not quite as good as some of the early 70s cards. 79, definitely the year that the creativity dried up in the Topps art department. And I think it went through that way through 1982. And again, I think it's just cyclical. You know, we've talked about the cycles in the 60s where Topps had a great stretch in the early to mid 60s, got a little dull in the mid to late 60s, came right back with some good sets throughout the 1970s. And it was just time. They just hit their lull and they would have a nice little renaissance in the 1980s. That actually in many ways carried on, even though I'm not a big fan of 88 Topps or 86 Topps for that matter. You know, for the most part, the creativity in Topps came back in 83 and really stuck around for many years after that. But it was just part of the cycle here. They were due to have a couple of duds. And unfortunately for Topps, it happened when the market opened up. with Fleer and Donruss in 1981. Although, I will say that Topps still had the best of the three designs in both 1981 and 1982. The bar was set pretty low, but they were still leading the way in terms of design. So the 79 Topps, the front design is not very well liked by collectors, but it is not universally hated. And I think that's a very important point to make out there. Now let's flip the card over. As you can see, Topps with competition coming goes back to the trusted and true green, a color that they just swaddled themselves in the 1970s and would continue to into the 1980s at various times. But the green that we saw in the back of the 1974, 76, and 77 Topps, it's right back here. As well as the basic design, this is almost like the back of the 76 Topps cards. The only difference is there was not a baseball bat running vertically from top to bottom along the left side. You have the card number in a circle in the upper left-hand corner. You have the player's name and personal information running horizontally across the top. You have a panel that covers basically two-thirds of the card on the left side with the complete player's record. If space permitted, you would have some interesting little tidbit about the player, and in this case you do with a stolen bases note at the bottom left portion of the card. And on the right side, you have this little panel. In the past, you would have a cartoon. In 78 Topps, you had the play ball game. Here you had baseball dates or some kind of interesting baseball trivia. And in this case, it's, you know, what happened in September of 1919. The Giants and Phillies played a game in 51 minutes, shortest nine-inning game in history. Mark Fedrick might have been pitching. Oh, no, 1919. Now, this was well before his time. But basically, Topps was relying on something that was tried and true. There was no doubt that this would be accepted by fans. Not only the color layout with the green and the black on the gray cardstock, but just the simple layout of the back of the card. You've got stats, you've got personal information, you've got trivia, and there you go. That's it. Nothing truly exciting, but the back of the card is nothing to be upset about. It is very easy to read. It does feel quite familiar because you saw a similar layout just a few years ago, again in 76 Topps, and you've seen that color numerous times. And if you're looking for just the facts, the Joe Friday edition of a back of a baseball card, that is exactly what you got in 79 Topps. So the overall design, in my opinion, you're looking at a card that, again, is not bad. This is not one of those sets where I say, stay away. In fact, it is kind of a neat set to collect. It's not a set that is overwhelming with rookie cards. There is one key rookie, which we'll get to in a moment. But, you know, this is a set that, let me put it this way, you normally don't clamor for it. Now, there are some exceptions. Maybe you were born in 1979 or 1979 was the first year that you really collected baseball cards. So you always have that personal connection to that set. But most collectors don't go out of their way for 79 Topps. And that's just because, again, it doesn't quite have that feel that some of the previous sets had. The design leaves a little to be left desired. And of course, hindsight being 2020, we know the dry spell that Topps will go through over the next 3 to 4 years before producing a winner in 1983. And because of that, you just kind of get this overwhelming feeling when you look at 79 Topps. A 726 card set, the big card, and the one card that really keeps 79 Topps going, card number 116, the Ozzie Smith rookie card. Ozzie with the mutton chops and the old San Diego Padres softball jersey of 1978. That is, without a doubt, the biggest card there. And then after that, there's really not a whole lot of rookie cards that grab your attention. There are some veteran cards that stand out because of printing issues or double printing issues. Pete Rose, Nolan Ryan, Mike Schmidt. Also, there is the legendary Bump Wills error card. Wills was a member of the Texas Rangers, yet for some reason, Topps ran a few thousand of his cards that said Blue Jays at the bottom of the card. So there is a little bit of a chase for that, but not really. It's not one of those cards where if you get one version over the other, it's $1,500 as opposed to $1.50. But some people do look for the Bump Wills Blue Jays card because it is a rather unique error. Also, it should be noted, Thurman Munson's last card featured in this set, of course, he would pass away in the plane crash in August of 1979. And you do have the usual collection of rookie cards, the three-panel pictures. This is when Topps moved away from the four pictures that were designated by position and moved on to rookie cards featuring three prospects from a team. And that was a practice that they would continue for several more years. And you had your record breakers, you had your league leaders leading off the set as well. And 79 Tops is still quite readily available. That is one of the good things. It is part of that window of cards from the mid to late 70s throughout the early 80s that, you know, production was increased. There were more cards made, but not quite junk wax era status, where these are still plentiful. For the most part, they're still affordable. So they are easy to collect. And if you go to a card shop or a card show and you've got a dealer that just has a box full of common cards or even semi-star or star cards, you know, because again, other than the Ozzie Smith card, there's really nothing that is an incredible standout card in that set. You can get them pretty easily. You know, the common cards you might be able to get for as little as 10 cents if the, you know, the shop owner wants to get rid of them. And some of the semi-star and star cards you could probably get for, you know, a buck a piece, depending on who the player is. So even though this is, again, one of those sets that you don't really go, you know, tripping over your feet for, this is one where if you get the opportunity to buy a whole bunch of them, I say go ahead. You know, it is a card set that's almost 40 years old. You do have some legendary players. I mean, you've got second and third year cards for Robin Yount and Paul Molitor and Dale Murphy and George Brett, you know, all the big cards from the mid 70s. You've got star cards like Mike Schmidt and Nolan Ryan, like I mentioned. You could still get some cards from some pretty good players at a pretty cheap price. So, again, I wouldn't avoid the set, but, you know, don't overspend on it. Also, be very careful. This is one of those sets that's still pretty available in wax packs and wax boxes, but, and this has been a problem with our hobby for a long time, but it is something with the advent of eBay and more sales being done online as opposed to in person. Be very careful about purchasing quote-unquote unopened products from 79 Tops. And it's the same for the late 70s and early 80s baseball cards that are out there. Because 79 Tops only has really that Ozzie Smith card, you do have some rather unscrupulous people who buy the wax packs, very gently open them up, search the star cards, whatever star cards they take, they replace them with some common cards, and they very carefully close the pack up again. There are signs of how packs can be open. You know, I'm not going to get into them too detailed here, but there are certain ways that packs that are resealed, you can look for certain indicators. But the easiest indicator for any product that is opened and then resealed and resold, first of all, is especially if you're buying online, if the price is too good to be true, then it probably is. You know, if you see a 79 Tops wax pack that is deemed to be unopened and it's selling for $3, that is too good to be true. The wax packs from 79 Tops I typically see in the $15-$20 range. Sometimes you're lucky, you can get a break and you find one that for $10 or $12. But if it's under $10, it's probably too good to be true. Also, make sure you actually use the customer satisfaction scores before you buy something that is older, that there is a little more money involved. Click on the link that has the customer feedback. If the person selling this product has less than 98% customer satisfaction, just don't buy it. Don't take that risk. Read the comments of listener feedback or shopper feedback, I should say. And if you see somebody that is claiming that the packs have been open, it's just best to side on caution and don't buy it. So be prepared if you're going to buy a pack of 79 tops. Get it from a reputable dealer and be prepared to pay $15 or $20 for it. And even though you're paying more than, say, a pack of 85 tops, you're still getting a 38-year-old pack and 38-year-old gum with it, but the thrill of opening up something that hasn't seen the light of day since the Jimmy Carter administration. We opened up the 79 top cello pack a couple weeks ago in our wax pack auction, or in our wax ecstatic auction, I should say. You can't open a cello pack in a wax pack auction, can you? Well, we auctioned off a cello pack from 79 tops, and that definitely was not monkeyed with. And the cello packs from the late 70s and into the early 80s, it would change in 1983. It was basically vacuum sealed. So the good news is, you know, when a pack is not being opened up. The bad news is the vacuum sealing, sometimes it would crimp the corners a little bit and could do a little damage, not to mention basically steam pressing that bubble gum to the card for nearly four decades. So you've got the wax packs still out there. You've got the wax boxes. Cello packs are still available. Rack packs as well. And just be careful where you're buying them from. Make sure you're getting them from somebody you trust, or if it's somebody you haven't bought from before, make sure you're getting them from somebody with a 100% or damn close to a seller rating before you start investing money into it. But this is part of the fun era of baseball cards, where you can still afford to buy the wax. You could still afford to buy the packs. If you've got a few hundred dollars laying around, you can get the boxes. And those are, for the most part, sealed up and PSA approved. But this is part of the era of cards where they're somewhat rare, but they're still somewhat available to where the common man can go out and still buy them. So if you get the chance to buy a pack or buy a box or, you know, like I said, just buy a lot of these cards, just a couple hundred cards from a local dealer, that's a good thing. Just beware of not only the counterfeit issues, but also beware of some double printing. There are some cards that are worth less than others because the way that the sheets worked out, 726 cards, it's not an even split. So the number is, 66 cards were double printed. And also you have the big problem of 1970s Topps cards, and that is bad cuts and also bad ink jobs. Sometimes some of the cards would come out, the pictures would be a little too heavy on some color, or some of the ink on the back would smudge. So you do have those typical condition issues, but if you're not too concerned about condition, you just want to get your hands on some classic cards. 79 Topps is a set that you don't go crazy for, but it's one you shouldn't overlook. It is not a bad set in general, especially if you like that classic Topps logo, because you can't miss it on every card. Now, if you were living in Kansas City or really anywhere in Missouri in the 1970s, you couldn't miss Amos Otis, or as I said before, A.O., as he was called in Kansas City throughout the 1970s. He is our random pull in this 1979 Topps podcast, card number 360, and a very interesting story about how Amos Otis became a legend in Kansas City. You would have had no idea that he would turn into the player that he eventually became when he was first drafted in 1965. And his movement from the time he was drafted to his arrival in Kansas City featured some rather dubious moves by teams, and he will forever be linked to one of the worst trades in Major League Baseball history, certainly New York Mets history. And some will argue that he was involved, directly involved, in the worst trade. So we'll get to that in a moment. But first, Amos Otis, born and raised in Mobile, Alabama, a hotbed of baseball prospects in the 1950s in particular. That's where Hank Aaron came from, Willie Mays, numerous other African-American stars came from the Mobile Bay region. And once you started cranking out an Aaron and a Mays and other guys like that, well, guess what? Major League scouts, even for teams like the Boston Red Sox, who didn't care much for African-American players, well, they suddenly stocked up on scouts that went through southern cities, not only established southern minor league towns, but also towns that were former homes of Negro League teams and also basically sandlot teams. There were some talented players who had yet to be seen. So teams started, suddenly putting staff out in these cities that had been overlooked, and the players that had been overlooked were finally starting to be seen. And Amos Otis was one of them, and the Mets, ironically, scouted out Amos, as well as several other players, at Shea Stadium, an invite-only scouting opportunity. I believe it was 1964, and the Mets said, hey, we'll give you a call back, and they never did. Well, in the summer of 65, the Boston Red Sox see Amos Otis available, and they draft him in the fifth round of the amateur draft. That, of course, the first amateur draft. And he starts going up through the Red Sox minor league system, which is an absolute nightmare because his rookie league team was in Kentucky. And you can only imagine a black man playing professional baseball in small town Kentucky in 1965. Not a very pleasant experience for him and another black teammate. He's able to push through that. Stars in 1966 in Onondaga, New York, and the Mets are able to circle back and nab Otis in the 66 minor league draft. That was one of the many smaller drafts where players were moved around before the days of free agency. There were certain stipulations in games played and contracts where certain players could be unprotected, and then a parent club would pick off the player in the minor league. So he starts making his way up through the Mets minor league system and makes his debut in 1967, has a relatively lengthy cup of coffee, 19 games in 1967, hitting .220. And Wes Westrum, the manager of the Mets back then. And Otis was an infielder. He was primarily a shortstop growing up, but he could be a utility guy, shortstop, third base. They put him at second every now and then. And it seemed like the Mets were going to have their third baseman of the future. And because the Mets felt this way, they decided to label Otis as an untouchable. And that's a double-edged sword. It's like being labeled gifted, you know, when you're going into the third grade. It means you're smart and you're somebody who's going to succeed in school, but also means you're going to get teased and beat up every now and then. That was kind of the situation with Otis here. Because he was labeled an untouchable, teams started sniffing around. Well, what's so untouchable about this guy? Maybe he isn't untouchable. Maybe we can make a trade for him. And then you had the pressure of being labeled an untouchable, especially in New York. And you've got this, Mets team that was building up all these prospects here. People had some great expectations for Amos Otis as he's climbing his way up the Mets farm system in 1968 and 1969. Believe it or not, there were some pretty interesting trades that were tossed about where Otis would have been the guy leaving New York. The Atlanta Braves were trying to trade Joe Torre to New York for Amos Otis. And again, you know, the word got out, well, he's untouchable. We can't move him. So you had a lot of interesting deals that would have been a blockbuster in the sense of big names going to New York, with Otis being the prospect, you know, the big prospect going in return the other way. Well, as he's making his way up through the minor league system, and as the Mets repeatedly tell teams, no, you can't have him. Well, the expectations are this is, you know, the third baseman of the future for this team. He's going to do great things, and he's really going to be a cornerstone for this infield for the next 10 or 12 years. Well, along comes Gil Hodges, and Gil Hodges is not so impressed with Amos Otis, not as much as the rest of the brass in the New York Mets system. So Otis starts clashing with Gil Hodges, And there were some thoughts that Otis was a little stubborn. Of course, he'd already been branded, you know, untouchable. So why wouldn't you be? But he was also a guy that apparently just needed that little push every now and then. And even Otis would acknowledge that he tended to play his best when he was put in a rather tough position. So he starts the 1969 season with the Mets at third base. But veteran third baseman Ed Charles, and when I say veteran, I mean this is just the journeyman guy who suddenly found his moment in the spotlight with the 69 Mets. Well, Ed Charles starts getting the reps at third base, and Otis gets moved to the outfield. And of course, he's a very speedy guy, so it seems to make sense that you move him to the outfield and cover a lot of the ground out there. Well, he's clashing with Gil Hodges. He's not hitting the ball as well. All of a sudden, this untouchable tag seems to be hanging over him like an albatross. So in the middle of the 1969 season, the Mets decide to upgrade the outfield with the acquisition of Don Clendenin from Montreal. So that means Amos Otis is now, you know, an extra outfielder for a team that is in a pennant race, doesn't really want to play the prospects now. They want to play the sure thing players. And he gets sent back to AAA. And, of course, the rest is history. Clendenin and the Mets end up winning the World Series in 1969. Otis would be a September call-up, but he wasn't on the postseason roster, so he couldn't be part of that 1969 World Series celebration. And again, Gil Hodges, who had helped make this Mets team become a world champion, well, he clearly wasn't going to go anywhere anytime soon. So the future didn't look too promising for Otis as a member of the New York Mets. So the Mets decide, hey, Ed Charles is an older guy here. I think Charles was, I want to say he was like 35 at the time. Otis is a guy that doesn't fit in well with Gil Hodges. We've got our outfield solved. Let's move him for a proven third baseman. So this would be one of those prospect for star player kind of trades. So they make a deal with the Kansas City Royals. Of course, Kansas City just having this team for its second year going into the 1970 season. And the Royals would send Joe Foy, a third baseman who was a member of the 67 Dream Team for the Boston Red Sox, left exposed in the expansion draft. Foy goes to the Mets in exchange for Amos Otis and Bob Johnson. Now, Bob Johnson would get traded later for Freddie Pottek and a couple of other players with the Pittsburgh Pirates. So some of the key pieces of the very quickly rising Kansas City Royals would come in through this deal. And this would not only send the Royals in the right direction, but it would ultimately send the Mets in the wrong direction. And here's why. So Joe Foy comes in, a very talented third baseman, like I said, part of that Red Sox team in 67, a pretty steady player for the Royals in 69. But by 1970, he starts getting into some drug problems, most notably marijuana. In fact, he was high as a kite for several games for the Mets in 1970. And the Mets really didn't want to deal with him anymore, so they trade him to the Washington Senators in 1971. And his off-the-field problems continue to mount, and he is cut by the Senators in the middle of the 71 season, and then that's it. So poor Joe Foy, who was a New York native, New York City native, coming back to his home city, and the pressures of dealing with the New York fans and media and the expectations, plus his recreational drug use, it all snowballed. He was out of baseball by the end of the 1971 season. Tragically, Joe Foy would die of a heart attack at the age of 46 in 1989. Now, while that story is tragic for the Mets, this would be the first domino of things falling apart. After giving up on Amos Otis and then not having a solution for third base after giving up on Joe Foy, the Mets decide, okay, let's try this again. Oh, here's this pretty talented infielder from the California Angels, Jim Fregosi. Let's go get him. And you know the rest of the story. Jim Fregosi, part of a package that the Mets received where they shipped out one Lynn Nolan Ryan. And you know how that worked out. If you don't, listen to our 93 FLIR Ultra podcast with Nolan Ryan as the random pull. But suffice to say, the movement of Amos Otis and the clashing that he had with Gil Hodges would have some rather unintended consequences a couple of years later after the failed experiment of Joe Foy at third base, then the movement of Nolan Ryan for Jim Fregosi, and the Mets would stumble their way. Granted, they made it to the World Series in 1973, but afterwards they would stumble their way for pretty much the next 10 years before eventually rebuilding into the Miracle Mets of the mid-1980s. So Amos Otis goes to Kansas City, and he becomes a star out there, not at third base, but as an outfielder. The original Municipal Stadium that the Royals played in, as did the Athletics when they were there, a lot of pasture to graze on out there. That was a pretty big outfield, so a speedy guy like Otis, he could just run all over the place, and he would do so in the equally spacious but even speedier, with the artificial turf, Royal Stadium, now Kauffman Stadium. A lot of open land out there, and he would use that to the best of his ability. Otis would be an all-star for Kansas City in four consecutive seasons from 1970 to 1973, and he was also an all-star in 1976. A little bit of interesting, trivial history for baseball fans out there. Who hit the last home run in Municipal Stadium for the Kansas City Royals? Yes, it was Amos Otis, not known for his power, but he could swing the bat relatively well. He averaged 16 home runs a season, had 193 home runs in a total of 17 seasons, and he was almost shipped in 1976, but it was a deal that was nixed. He would have gone to the Pittsburgh Pirates in a deal that Cookie Rojas and Al Oliver would have gone to Kansas City, but Rojas was a veteran. He had the 10-5 rule. That was 10 years in the major leagues, 5 years with one team. And, that was basically the only power that certain players had in negotiations back then. If they were a 10-5 player, they could nix any trade. And that's what happened. So Otis would stay in Kansas City. And that turned out to be a pretty good thing throughout his career. And that, of course, turned out to be a very good thing, not only being an all-star in 76, but being a mainstay in the Kansas City outfield throughout the 1970s, a key player in the Royals' playoff appearances in 1976, 77, and 78, all years where they fell to the Yankees, but in 1980, they finally beat the Yankees and eventually lose to the Phillies in the World Series. Now, all good things, unfortunately, must come to an end as his playing time starts winding down. He was still pretty productive at the plate, as he was averaging about 275 at this time, but also, he was still pretty solid in the field. He was just getting up there in years, and as is often the case, teams would rather move on from aging veteran players for younger, cheaper prospects. Much like the Mets decided to keep Ed Charles and try Joe Foy instead of Amos Otis, the Royals eventually said, okay, Otis has been a rather serviceable player for us, but we need to move on, and we're going to have Willie Wilson planted in center field. And he was granted free agency after the 1983 season. Signed as a free agent with the Pittsburgh Pirates, ironically, in 1984, but his stay in Pittsburgh would be rather short, appearing in just 40 games, batting 165, and getting released before the end of the 84 season. In fact, August 5th, 1984, as the Pirates were going through their own rebuilding on and off the field at the time. And that would be the end of Amos Otis's baseball career. 1,998 games, 2,020 hits, as I mentioned, 193 homers, 374 doubles, and he did have those five All-Star seasons. He was also a Gold Glove winner three times, and believe it or not, was in the MVP race for several moments in his career. His best case for MVP came in 1973, where he finished behind the winner, Reggie Jackson, and the runner-up, Jim Palmer. So even though time has unfortunately forgotten a lot about Amos Otis's career, he was really one of the best, most solid, consistent players in the American League in the early to mid 70s. And that 1973 season, by the way, not only was he an all-star in front of the home crowd, the all-star game at Royal Stadium that year, but he batted 300 and had his best career year in terms of home runs with 26. Second best year in RBI with 93. He had 96 in 1978. After his playing career wound down, he got into coaching, was a longtime member of the Colorado Rockies coaching staff, and to everyone's knowledge is still doing well. He's 70 years old, but he is still very loved by Royals fans. He's part of the Royals Hall of Fame. He was inducted with Steve Busby in 1986. And even though he didn't get a lot of love from the Hall of Fame voters in Cooperstown, he is still regarded as one of the cornerstones of that up-and-coming Kansas City Royals team in the mid-1970s. And they were good, but just not good enough to beat the Yankees. And the Yankees were a powerhouse by the time you got to 77 and 78. So it was just bad timing for the Royals. You know, they had such a sharp rise to competitiveness, but just weren't able to close out the deal in some of those series in the late 70s. Finally able to do it in 1980. So there's a look at Amos Otis, a random poll from the 1979 top set. If you have anything to say about him or the set, feel free to do so at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. I do encourage you to share the Wax and Gum Stains handle to all of your collecting friends. Those who collected back in the day, those who still collect now, let's take a quick look at the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, as a lot of people commenting not only on our 1978 Tops podcast, but also the tease that we sent out. We said, if you don't listen to this podcast today, we will send you Velvet Greg Minton to your house. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just look up 1978 Topps Greg Minton. That is one of the legendary, awful airbrushed cards. And 78 Topps, for as much as I love that set, they did have a tendency, if they didn't have a stock photo of a player, they decided to basically repaint the player. I believe Mike Paxton of the Red Sox is a full portrait. It is not a picture. It is a portrait of him. Greg Minton is a full portrait as well. It is not a good portrait. It's kind of like that portrait of Jesus Christ as done by that old Spanish lady. Remember that a few years ago? The Spanish lady was supposed to touch up this this portrait, trying to remember, it might have been a Da Vinci painting, this famous painting of Jesus Christ that had just, you know, fallen apart over the years. She was supposed to touch it up, and it just turned out to be this awful, blurry painting. That's kind of what Greg Minton is here, although Minton was apparently a pretty loose cannon between the ears anyway, so maybe he would have liked that card to begin with. But a lot of people liked not only that tease, but our podcast on 78 Tops, and in particular, our subject of Mark Fidrick. Doug McCready chiming in, greatest podcast I've ever heard. Fidrick was Detroit. He gave us hope. Opening these cards in anticipation of getting my team was the best. Let's see. Robert Lawson was looking forward to the podcast, one of his favorites of the 1970s. Pete Scribner on 78 Tops, the first pack of cards I ever got. I was 5 years old at the time, and I still vividly remember my grandfather buying them for me. You always remember your first. For me, 89 Tops. For Pete, 78 Tops. And I'm glad that we were able to bring back that great moment with your grandfather. And Pete would continue, for some reason, the only card I remember from that pack, though, was Reds infielder Rick Auerbach. And he includes a picture of the Rick Auerbach card, and probably because Auerbach has the Kent Tekulve glasses going here. He is photographed in Candlestick Park. You can see that. But he has this menacing glare, like somebody just ripped a fart over at second base, and he is not pleased to be downwind. Some other thoughts from our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. I can't find this tweet. I don't know what happened to it. I hope I didn't erase it. But regards to our 78 Tops random poll, Mark Fidrick, I had mentioned how Detroit, you know, a lot of the problems Detroit is going through now The problems were set in motion back in the mid-1960s, and I went through how you had race riots, you had the economy downturns several times in the 1970s, poor political decisions, political corruption. So a lot of the problems you see in Detroit in 2017, they go back to 1967 with the race riots and just a whole series of unfortunate events and bad decisions and bad leadership. And we had a listener, and I wish I could find this tweet. Unfortunately, I can't. A listener who said, hey, you know, things aren't all that bad in Detroit. It's getting better. And this listener was from Michigan. And I mentioned in a response, but, you know, I didn't mention this in the show just because I didn't have time. But I know that Detroit is on the rebound. I was actually in Detroit a few years ago. This was 2014. I was in Detroit visiting a friend who was running a radio station there at the time. And I was only there for a day, but you know, we hit all the hot spots in Detroit and went across the river to Windsor for dinner. But I can see there are certain pockets of Detroit that are rebounding. Certainly the downtown core, that is the focus. The area around Comerica Park is really nice. The area around what will be Little Caesars Arena, the new home for the Red Wings and the Pistons, will be nice. It's good to see the Pistons moving from Auburn Hills back to downtown Detroit. So people have more of a reason to visit downtown. The key is, will people have a reason to live in or close to downtown? That is yet to be seen. But make it clear, I don't want to make it seem like Detroit is just this pit. Detroit has certainly had its problems, and it will not be an easy rebirth, but you can see the rebirth of Detroit. But I think my point is that the problems of 50 to 60 years don't get solved in 5 or 6 years. Honestly, it may take 50 to 60 years for the full rebound to happen, and I think Detroit hit absolute rock bottom, you know, 8 to 10 years ago with the recession, with the car makers again flailing, you know, financially. And then, of course, the bankruptcy of 2013, that was pretty embarrassing. So they're on the up and up. I don't know if Detroit will ever be the industrial powerhouse that it once was. I don't know if Detroit will ever be as large as it once was in population. You know, they've had a population downturn since the 1950s, but I really do believe that Detroit is going to flourish once again, not as a manufacturer of cars or auto parts or stuff like that. It will find its niche, and there will be people that will go to Detroit. If you can live through the winters, you know, the winters can be pretty harsh in Detroit, but if you can live through the winters, Detroit is actually a halfway decent place, at least the areas that I visited. And I know the state of Michigan is absolutely beautiful in the spring and the summer. So I really do hope that Detroit does come out on top eventually. It will take time, though. It's not something you're going to see automatically in just a few years. At the very least, you're looking at 10 to 20 years from now to make sure that it's going in the right direction, and hopefully Detroit has the right politicians, the right leadership to get it there. And finally, Jordan Grief tweeting us, congrats on 1,000 followers. Wow. Yeah, we had 1,000 followers on our Twitter feed. We're actually at 1,020 right now. So we picked up a few listeners over the last several days. And while we certainly do appreciate the congratulations on that, we want to thank you, the listener, for making it happen. So continue to pass along the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. And also tell your friends that Wax Ecstatic comes your way with new podcast every Tuesday at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time. We have Flashback Friday episodes throughout the weekend. And again, we will be changing the course just a little bit. After 1980 Tops next week, we will be just doing random pulls from binders and boxes, and we'll just talk about the players and the sets. And we will occasionally, eventually, it won't be right off the bat, but eventually we'll start sprinkling in some guests and also a look back at rapper art from the Wax Packs, looking at some baseball memorabilia, and a whole lot more. So make sure you tune in next Tuesday for our newest episode as we do the final set from the big old binder, 1980 Tops. If you thought 79 was depressing, 1980 was, as Tops was just readying itself for the competition. We'll have some more details about that and a random poll as well. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.